The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to the fourth edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And we got a lot to get to in a little bit. Interview with Emily Pierce. There are very few people in this business I have more respect for and more in awe of than Emily. We went to school together years ago at WSET, and she went and crushed that, and she's got her advanced from the Corps de Master Sommelier, and she'll very soon become a master. Master Somm. It's only a matter of time. She's the director of one of the most exclusive private clubs in Canada, the York Club, and the wine list is crazy, and she is in charge of it. I couldn't be proud of her. So we get to that in a little bit. It's about a 40-minute interview. Really interesting, again, for people that are either into wine or hardcore, or if you are new to it, I think you'll really enjoy the story of someone who has worked damn hard to get to where they are. So I want to get to a couple things. First, every week I'm always going to try to recommend a wine. And, you know, sometimes people wonder, are you going to trash a wine? And I'm not. And it's not me trying to be all goody two-shoes or anything like that. It's just that I'd rather tell you about a wine that I really like and a wine that excites me than going on and on for a wine that I think is crap. And there's plenty out there that I can't stand, from cheap Napa Cabernet Sauvignon to expensive Australian red from, like, say, Barossa. There's a lot of wines that I'm not a fan of. Sometimes it's just my palate. Sometimes I think some of these wines are just bad. But all wine, there is so much work and effort that goes into it. And, you know, from just, you know, guys getting, like, minimum wage and not having the best living conditions who are picking the grapes, to really smart people blending and deciding when to pick the grapes, and just everything that goes into it. It's such an insecure world. It's such a difficult world because, you know, you really are at the mercy of nature, especially if you make good wine. If you make bad wine, then you can chemical up everything. And, well, those are wines I probably don't like. But I'd rather just talk about wines that I enjoy. So I'll start out by that. I'll give my wine recommendation first. And then after that, I'll give you another wine tip about how to be a snob, how to be a wine expert without knowing anything about wine. So the wine I'm going to recommend, and I'm going to screw up so much of this, it's a Spanish wine, a Gran Reserva, Monasterio de las Viñas Gran Reserva. It is, and yeah, I know I screwed it up, under 18 bucks at the LCBO. It's a Grenache Tempranillo. 50% Grenache, 40% Tempranillo, then 10% Carignan. Comes from an area called Aragon in a smaller region called Carignana, which is just a little bit east of Rioja. And Rioja, for people who know, is one of the sort of big wine regions, one of the most famous wine regions in all of Spain. And I think one reason why this wine is only $17.95 is, as I discuss all the time, geography, geography, geography. This area is not as famous as Rioja or Ribera del Duero or Priorat or some of the other areas. So you can just find some value. And listen, this wine has spent 2 years in French oak. It's spent 3 years in bottle. They've aged this wine. And for people who want to know, when you see, and I won't go over all the numbers, you can look it up, it's easy, and I don't want to, you know, really just weigh you down. But when you go to the Spanish section, and a lot of the areas, especially like Rioja or this area, Ribera del Duero, you'll see like Crianza, Reserva, Gran Reserva. Basically, it just means the amount of time it spends aging in either oak and also in bottle. And from Crianza to Reserva to Gran Reserva, the higher the level, the more time it has to spend being aged. And this wine is 2010, and it's 18 bucks. And what I love about this wine is, first, it is easy drinking, but it's easy drinking with some depth. And that's always the sweet spot you want from your lesser, you know, expensive wines, or your more value wine. You know, you don't want a wine that you just There's nothing there. But at the same point, for $17.95, you're not going to sit and, you know, brood over this and spend hours debating just exactly what the fruit profile is. But this wine's got a lot going on. Sweet, dark fruit on both on the nose and on the palate as well. There is some spice. It's kind of a dry spice. I don't know if that makes sense, but it does to me. On the nose, also get perfume, like some greenish herbal notes, tea. I mean, there's a lot going on. And then on the palate, as I said, the tea bag comes out. That sounds dirty. Let's just move on. But you do. You get dark fruit, dark berries, but there's a bit of a sweet note to it that obviously comes from the amount of time it's spent in oak. Yeah, just, you know, really good. And because it's had time to age, you know, it's calmed down. It's not tight. It's really smooth. It's exactly what you want. In Spain, you know, I always talk about Italy, and Italy's always my favorite place, usually for value. The same is the case here in Spain. If you can find it, you can find some great wines. And the great thing, as I said, is that, you know, these wines have spent plenty of time aging. It's one of the characteristics of Spanish wine from this specific area. So check it out. You can find it at the LCBO. If you're listening outside of Ontario, Monasterio de la Vinesse, or Vinesse. God, I screw it up all the time. You can find them. They're a large producer. And if you can't find them, just go to whatever wine store. And the larger area is called Aragon. Aragon, just east of Rioja. See if you can find wines from that area, especially blends of Grenache, Tempranillo, and Carignan, and especially heavy on the Grenache and Tempranillo. No offense to Carignan, but it's not meant to be the primary grape. So if you can go find it, go find a Reserva, a Grand Reserva. Should be under $20 if you can't find this specific one. And again, this represents really good value. I'm rushing through this because interview with Emily Pierce is coming up in a little bit. So here is one tip to be a wine expert. And you don't want to spend all your time studying like the Bruce Wallners, Emily Pierce's, or myself to a far lesser extent than them. I don't want to put myself in the same category. But be vaguely negative. Now, about a wine, when you're out for dinner or, again, at a party, whatever, at a wedding, you don't want to say you hate the wine that's being served. No one likes a Debbie Downer at a party. Also, you may be forced to defend yourself if you're completely dismissive about the glass of Chianti you're drinking at the dinner table. Instead, drop this line. It's nice, but this Chianti, it kind of dies in the mid-palate. Who's going to argue with you when you use a term like mid-palate? You know, remember, most of the people around you, you know, they have their own wine insecurities. You know, they're not going to question you. They're going to nod, and they're going to think, oh, this guy may be a little bit of a jackass, but apparently he knows a couple things about wine, and they'll just sort of believe you. Or one other thing you can say is that this wine, I enjoy it, but it doesn't really have a very long finish. I was expecting something more, and those are the sort of lines you would expect from someone who is in the know, but now that you're the one saying it, then hey, you'll be the one in the know. So vaguely negative about a wine will again go a long way in proving to people, even though you may be a fraud, proving to people that, hey, this fella or this lady, she really knows what she's talking about when it comes to wine. Speaking of which, we're going to get to the Emily Pierce interview in just a second. Again, she soon will be a Master Sommelier from the Court of the Court of Master Sommelier and is the wine director at the York Club. I've known her forever. We went to school together. Really fun interview. And a reminder, again, thank you very much for everyone who's listening. Tell your friends, people that want to get into wine, tell them about the podcast. Hardcore people that love wine, tell them as well, because at the very least, they'll get to listen to, even if they don't want to hear my gas bagging, they'll get to hear from some of the most interesting and some of the most knowledgeable people in the world of wine. You can find me on YouTube, Stitcher, and Audioboom. Please feel free, rate, review, and again, tell your friends, thanks for listening. And now it's time for Emily Pierce. Joining me in terms of interesting and one of the most impressive people I know in the world of wine, certainly the hardest working. I mean, we can argue about smartest, about knowledge, and that's kind of subjective, but there's no one that has worked harder to get into this business and to get in the position she is than Emily Pierce. Emily, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I think we should start by saying that we were way back in the day, we were classmates back WSET days about... like 7 years ago now? How long ago was it?
Oh my goodness, I don't know. I think it would have been about 7 years ago now.
Yeah. I mean, just crazy. And you went from there to where you are now, that your job, you're working with the York Club.
Yes.
I want to get into that. I want to get into just some of the bottles you see on a regular basis. Because you'll send me, you know, you'll tell me about it later on when I see you, about like bottles you've opened, and then my mouth is just agape.
Yes.
But I want to get started just with your own journey. How for you did you get into wine? What was it about wine that made you want to just really just devote your life to it?
Well, good question. So about 8 years ago, I was working for the government of Ontario in the Ministry of Economic Development and Finance. I always joke, not to offend any bureaucrats that might be listening to this, but working for the government drove me to drink. And but all joking aside, I was taking some culinary arts courses at George Brown.
Yeah.
And I was just simply enchanted with my French cuisine course and the chef that was teaching it. And the dishes that she was teaching, like bouillabaisse and beautiful things from all over French. And they were very regional, and it had to do with a very specific time and place and people that were making the dishes for certain regions. And it was, I thought it was so fascinating. And then I sort of thought, well, what about wine? And that's when I first started to explore the idea of learning about wine and studying wine. I started to take WSET, as you know, and Moonlight.
And WSET, by the way, because
I'm so sorry.
No. No, it's my fault. I said WSET, but it's the Wine Spirits Education Trust. Started, I think, in London in the mid-1950s.
There you go.
That's me just trying, for the people listening, going, what the bleep is WSET?
Yes. So yeah. I started doing that. That was great. And I also started moonlighting at an Italian restaurant in Toronto called Tironi. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that all while working for the government of Ontario. And for all intents and purposes, I came to, I guess you could say, a natural Rubicon in my life, where I had to decide whether or not I was going to try to stay on with the government, my contract had ended, or if I was going to make that leap and pursue wine as a full-time endeavor. Obviously, I made the leap.
Yep.
And I truly feel like I really haven't worked a day since. I love what I do. I'm very passionate about what I do, and I think I'm very blessed to be able to do it.
And in terms of, you say you don't work, but I mean, we'll get into that as well, just because what I want people to know is, for a lot of people that are listening, they've seen the Saw movie.
So, yes.
You know, that going for the master and the advanced level with the quartermaster sommelier. And, you know, why don't we start there, actually?
Sure.
Take us through a light day for Emily and a heavy day for you in terms of studying.
Okay. That's a good question.
Now, is it really a good question, or are you stalling for a second to think of the answer? And also, by the way, later in the interview, but I want to give you some time.
Well, no, it's a good question. I was thinking to myself, well, what kind of day of the week are you talking about? Because I'm trying to get on an average what I do. So, you know, it depends if I'm riding my bike to work or if I'm taking the TDC. It's all these little things that kind of affect what I do. I try to generally get to work early, maybe around 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I'll study from 8 a.m. till about 10:30, 11 o'clock. And then I will do my lunch service from 11 till 3 o'clock. And then I do a French lesson for another wine competition reason.
Yep.
So I do a French lesson, then try to grab some quick yoga. And then I do dinner service from 5 until, you know, I go home at about 9:30.
Yeah. So that's a pretty full day.
Yeah.
And where I've seen your place when you're a hardcore studying and It's wall to wall maps all over the, you know, all the famous, all the famous wine regions, the stacks of cue cards, like everything people see in those movies. It's 100% true. They're not cooking it. There's no hyperbole in terms of the level of study that people like you put into this, whether it's for competitions or it's to eventually become a master somm.
It's truly a phenomenal amount of work. I look back at my time in university and I smile because I thought I was working really, really hard then.
Yeah. It's not even close.
And I think that it's been an incredible journey up to this point that I'm continuing on still. Yeah. And it's very humbling because as much as you learn, the more you understand that you do all these things you don't learn or you don't understand. And it's very humbling to know that it's, I think when you first start out in wine, that first year, you are really a pro, you know, so much about everything in the world of wine. And I remember it was about a week before I was sitting my Master Sommelier Theory exam. And, I remember having a conversation with someone on my staff and saying, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do. Like, I actually know nothing about wine. Like, you're freaking out. Because, you know, there's just so many layers of questions and such intricacy to the world of wine.
Take us through the, because you've passed your advanced level for the quartermaster somm. So you're just the master away. And quite frankly, I've seen your study. I've seen your tasting grids. You've won contests in the past. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about contests as well. You could be a master somm now in terms of your knowledge and the work you put into it. It's no, you can. It's just sometimes they give you the one question in the area you don't know as well, or you know, you don't know, you forget some of the rivers in Spain, and then you know, bang.
Well, I don't know about that. Rivers are my jam.
Actually, that is true. Rivers are. I could just like throw out, you list the top 10 rivers in almost any wine region.
Yeah,
but
I do love that.
Take us through the advance. What for people, you know, just because you're on the ground, what was it like taking and passing your advanced sommelier in terms of what you had to know?
It was an incredibly grueling exam in terms of knowledge. You really need to know at a pretty considerable depth every major wine producing region in the world. There's also a lot of not even major, but sort of minor wine producing regions in the world. Mm-hmm. Regions come into it like Corsica, let's say, or Hungary or Croatia. Not particularly probably wine regions that pop up in your head.
No.
So you do need to know about that. So wine laws, you know, how long does something have to age? What's the blend of grapes in it? And then who are great producers in the region? Who really define those? Who defines those regions? So really theory about any wine region, any law, people, lore, so sort of history of the region is important, as well as viticulture. Little light on the viticulture vinification, a little dabble, a little sprinkle of that in there.
Yeah.
That would be what, and then the business of wine. So anything that has to do with actually being a sommelier, and then tasting and service as well.
And it's interesting, it's not just about wine, it is, as, and you just mentioned it, law, history, geography, science, all those disciplines go into it.
Oh, and I forgot, yes,
yeah.
Beer.
Yeah.
So any spirit, any alcoholic beverage, so beer, sake, scotch, cognacs, any liqueurs, cocktails, anything like that as well.
What can you remember from your tasting?
Not much. I think I like blacked out. I went into like I said into like some sort of focused Jedi place. I think.
Yeah.
I remember going in, and I sort of have this routine when I taste in exams. It probably seems quite peculiar.
What's
to
your
anyone.
Routine?
I walk in. I sit down. I take my watch off. I don't know if I should say this, but I take my shoes off. I slip my shoes off, and I arrange the glasses in sort of a diagonal line in front of me. Very odd. It's very, very odd. And I remember going into that, into my sort of warm-up, kind of like a basketball player, I guess, you know, for a free throw. There's a sports reference. That was good.
There you go.
I remember doing that. I remember walking in. I remember seeing one wine that really had a very distinctive color. And I kind of remember starting and going through it. And then I remember the end.
Where really?
You're sort of like, okay, I'm done. You look up and you're like, okay, I'm done.
So it's like a car crash. Like when they talk to someone who's in a car crash, what do they remember? Well, I remember getting in the car.
The beginning.
And now I remember talking to you. And everything in between I have no knowledge of.
I there's sprinkles, but not really.
Yeah.
Like some people ask me, like, well, what were the wines? I kind of don't know. I was having a conversation with somebody about that, actually, maybe 2 days ago. No idea. Like, I remember a couple, kind of.
All right, then, what do you remember from your service, if anything?
I really like doing service. It's, so, for anyone who doesn't know, they set up a kind of a fake restaurant. And you do different, there's different stations. So it might be serving sparkling wine or red wine, decanting red wine over a candle or carafing young white wine or serving scotches or serving, it could be anything that happens in a restaurant, which some people find very overwhelming. I really enjoy it. I work on the floor day to day.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. I enjoy doing it. I find it's a great way to connect with guests, to be able to have those connections. I just remember going into the service exam being very excited about it.
Yeah, which is different. A lot of people...
Oh, dread it.
They dread it. They hate it.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love it.
Because they can be mean to you. The judges can be mean. They're like throwing all these questions.
But you know what? Customers can be mean too.
Yeah, so that's true.
You just have to really look at it as... any other day working as a sommelier.
Yeah.
You're going to get people that ask you questions that are really hard, maybe that are a little ridiculous, but you know, you just do your job.
What's the role of a somm?
Goodness. I think it to make money.
Yeah. So the role of every other job on planet Earth.
So, you know, it's the sommelier is very important in that you are responsible for... a large percentage of revenue in your dining establishment.
Yeah.
So that varies depending on what kind of restaurant or club or wherever you might be, you know, anywhere between like 30 and 50% of revenue. But it's a pretty serious amount. So the primary role, as unsexy as that sounds, is to make money for the organization you work for and to manage those costs through inventory management, cost management, correct pricing, costing, things like that.
Yeah.
Moving inventory. That's if you can't do that well, you cannot be a sommelier. It's the sort of the side of being a sommelier that doesn't get shown in the movie because it's not really fun to look at.
No, it's not romantic to, but
absolutely
it's not. Also your if the somm does their job, his or her job well, then that's going to help everyone else at the restaurant.
Yes.
That's going to help keep the restaurant going, which is going to help keep people employed. It's not just, it's not the, it's not.
Beverages always, you have to think of it, it's like liquid money.
Yeah.
And restaurants open for the food, but it's really hard, but they stay open because of the beverage program. You need to have a revenue generating program that keeps you in the black. If you have a mismanaged beverage program, it's incredibly difficult to survive financially.
This might be a tricky question, and you can come back to it. Do you have any memories of just best or worst customers you've ever had, like people that you've served where at the end of the night, like what a bleep hole, or at the end of the night, that was such a wonderful experience with that person, couple, guest, party, or whatever?
Where I work now, I have great experiences all the time.
Yeah.
It's because I'm at a private club. Mm-hmm. The members, I see them on a regular basis. So you do get to know them quite a bit more than, say, if you were working at a restaurant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. It'd be very different than if you're working at Highs or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I can say it's been an incredibly rewarding experience getting to know all of the members and what they enjoy and how they like to dine. And I can say it's been great. Mm-hmm. Some of the best experiences I've had being a sommelier have been working here, and I am very grateful for it. I think it's a phenomenal place to work. So I'd have to say working here in the club, I've had the best experiences. Now, as for the not great experiences, you have a lot of horror stories about people just being absolutely ridiculous or miserable. I truthfully, I try to step back a little bit and think, my goodness, this person is being just toxic or ridiculous or
semi-drunk Bay Street D-bag who, you know, keeps ordering bottles of Silver Oak.
Not to paint a picture, not to generalize. And that's fine. There's all sorts of scenarios. But then you try to look at it as just another human being. Like, what is this person going through in their life that they're acting like this?
Yeah.
And when you can look at people as, you know, human beings.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot easier to manage. Because you think to yourself, like, well, gosh, I don't go out to dinner to be miserable or to be, you know, or to give people a hard time. What's going on in this person's life to do that? All right, you know what? That's fine. That's fine. I can take this. This is okay. So it doesn't really bother me. I just do my job. I do the best I can, provide the best service I can. And that's what I do.
All right. I want to flip the switch now. How has just you studying your foray into wine and how good you are at service, how has it affected you as a diner now versus say 10 years ago? How has it affected your dining experience?
Oh gosh, I don't know if I'd say it was better or worse. I will admit I can be a little picky, and that might be being very, very, very nice to myself. You know, I look, if you sit down and, you know, somebody puts a dirty glass or chipped glass in front of you, you notice it.
Yeah.
When you go to a restaurant or a hotel or something and you ask the sommelier about something on their list and they have no idea what it is or it's wrong on their list.
Yeah.
You kind of look at them and you're like, well, geez, isn't this your job? Shouldn't you know how to do this?
Think about how many more mistakes you notice now than a decade ago. I remember one time we went out at a very well, it's gone now, but a well-known wine bar in downtown Toronto. And some of the wines, they listed the vintage, and other wines, they didn't at all. And the wine list was a complete mess. And I remember going through it with you, and we were both just shocked that this restaurant, which was known as a really good wine bar, the information they're presenting to the customers was quite inaccurate.
That does happen. I will say that I am guilty of maybe critiquing wine lists. I would never mention it to this, you know, to the sommelier or make feel badly about it. I do notice it. That being said, I've found ridiculous mistakes in my own list.
Yeah.
Where I sort of stop and shake my head. I'm like, geez, Emily, like, what were you thinking? Like, why is there no appellation on this? Or why is there no vintage? I had one time where I didn't notice that Chardonnay was spelt with a U.
What?
Obviously, yeah. So it's Chardonnay. that actually happened. So it happens. It does happen. Like list correction is it's constant. A wine list is a dynamic thing that you have to constant. It's constant vigilance with these things. But yeah, I don't think I'm. I think I enjoy dining a lot more, but I know I'm a lot more aware, a bit more aware of what's going on.
But it also means you appreciate good service more than the average person.
Absolutely. I was in, New York at Le Bernardin, and I remember coming back to Toronto, and some people said, oh, how was it? I said, the food was great. The service was even better.
Yeah.
And when you do see that amazing service, you know what it takes to make it look flawless and elegant and seamless.
Yeah.
And you really appreciate it.
Yeah. I remember being, if we're going to do the New York thing, I remember being at Gramercy Park and sitting at the bar and bartender flawless and and she was working. There were so many other people there and was able to go through everyone and you felt special and any piece of information you wanted. And she's like, here, you try that wine here. Just try a little of this. Let me know what you think. And just all those little things. And you do appreciate it more. Same thing with Jacobs. Jacobs is crazy expensive. If it is going to be that expensive, the service better be that good. And I've only been there a couple times, and I was always blown away with that. It's just, you kind of appreciate the good service even more.
Yeah, I go there not, I wouldn't say frequently, but I do go there, I don't know, several times a year. And I love that place. It's one of my favorite steakhouses in the city, from Robbie sort of leading the beverage program and Doug on the floor and, you know, as the sommelier. And the service staff is also just so incredibly knowledgeable. They can tell you about anything. in detail on the menu. It's a great restaurant. It really is.
Yeah, 100%. This is always the hardest question. If you don't have an answer now, or if you don't have an answer at all, that's fine. But I'm always going to ask everyone who does this podcast, was there a bottle?
No.
Or a moment, that epiphany? And the thing is, for a lot of people, there wasn't. You know, I was...
People seem so disappointed when you say that.
Yeah.
Like, because you want to be like,
they want it. They want that story.
It was this 1999 Chevrolet Chambertin, and it blew my mind, and I've been chasing that bottle ever since. But I don't really think that there has been anything. I remember great glasses of wine.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're sort of like, wow, this is incredible. This is something I've never tasted before. I remember having that experience at Jamie Kennedy Wine Bar back in the day.
Yeah.
And it was a very, you know, expensive by the glass pour. And I thought, wow, my goodness, I had no idea wine could taste like that. I remember after a wine exam, I was a bunch of people, and we went to a casual Italian eatery and we drank a bottle of Burgundy. I thought, oh my gosh. You know, there's certain wines that stand out in my memory as being great, but I really don't think that there was that one bottle that did it for me.
Yeah. So you don't have that unicorn bottle, that one that you're chasing.
I wish I did, because then it would be a much better story, because I get asked that all the time.
Well,
I might just make one up.
I think you should. I think, you know, something like this, like you were going through, you know, you were in this addict and there it
was. I'll be like, it was the 2002 Conselman Bacco Noir.
Oh my, get out of here.
Sorry. Ugh. What was that? That was mean.
That would be horrible.
That was awful.
Listen. All right. For anyone listening, if you like Bacco Noir, that's great. If it makes you happy, that's fine. If you like everything, you love nothing. And for me, Bacco Noir is trash. I'm sorry. Ontario Bacco Noir is trash. But listen, I'm also like not a huge fan of, say, like Carmenere. I've yet to try one I've really liked. So, you know, and that's fine. That's not about being a wine snob. People don't like certain types of beer. People don't like
certain types
of meat or things like that. It's like anything else. Like, okay, let's go into this for a second. I always hate the term wine snob, because like it's a product like any other that brings me joy. I've recommended $9 bottles of wine, and I've tried 100 plus $300-$400 bottles of wine that I thought were trash. And if you don't like, if I say I don't like Moosehead, no one calls me a beer snob. But when I say I don't like the heavy reds from Barossa, suddenly I'm a wine snob.
Yes.
I hate that.
I toggle in between if I hate that or if I just don't care. Mm. I am who I am.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to say I'm a wine snob because I like drinking great wines.
Yeah.
I'm totally okay with that. There's enough boxed wine in the world left over for you to drink.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. I think that as you learn more about wine, your palate does develop.
Yeah.
You do evolve.
Yeah.
It's like if you study music, you're going to open your mind and you're going to learn and you're going to be able to appreciate things in a much more intricate detail.
Yeah.
So when you listen to something, when you listen to a symphony, you're going to be able to pick things out and you're going to be able to understand it more. And it's the same with wine. The more you learn about it, the more you understand it, the more you can appreciate these subtle nuances from different, you know, places in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is a term that's thrown around a lot. But I enjoy wines that are inexpensive. I wouldn't call them cheap.
Yeah.
I'd say they're inexpensive wines. They're good value wines.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy, there's many bottles around $20 that I would happily enjoy.
Yep.
Oh, 100%. And much like you, there's been wines that I've had, you know, first growth wines in certain years. I'm like, oh, this is just really flat. This is really hollow. This is not showing well. Like, I don't really think this is great. You know, people might look at you like, oh my gosh, this is a $3,000 bottle of wine. It's about that relative value. And is this a great $3,000 bottle of wine or is this a great $30 bottle of wine? It's like if you're going out and you're going to Jacob & Co., like as you said, is this a great $120 steak? You're going to have a little bit different standards if you're going and getting a $10 hamburger. So it's not necessarily an apples to apples thing. I think you can have a great hamburger, $10 hamburger, that you can give it a 10 out of 10, as well as, you know, give a $120 steak a different rating. So I kind of look at wines that way.
The O2 Conselman Bacco Noir. We got to work on your backstory just a little bit.
I just sort of came to me that it's like a punishment wine.
I got one friend, Susan Sterling, who's big into wine, and she's always trying to put, and she's probably listening. Hi, Susan. I'm sorry that she's trying to push back on noir. It has not happened. I'm going to ask you the James Lipton question.
Okay.
What for you, Emily Pierce?
Okay.
What for you is a great wine? What does that mean?
What is a great wine?
Yeah, and I don't mean one specific, but like just...
See, this
what
is,
for you
this
is the difference between a good wine and a bad wine?
So this is a very MW question,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So sort of a, you know, it's such an open-ended question. You
I
can
know.
Talk about it
it's
forever.
It's so open-ended.
Because when you mean great, do you mean great value? Do you mean great taste?
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean, you know, great at the moment? Great with food? It really depends what you mean. And also great to who? Great to me? Because what I think, this is exactly what you said. What I think was great to me, you might think, oh my gosh, this is awful. This is awful. My goodness. What if I'm into these like very silky, finessed, you know, light body, cool climate Pinots and you love robust valley floor, or, you know, Oakville Cabernet.
Yeah.
You're going to think everything I'm drinking is awful. So I don't know if it's possible.
Then let me switch this around. I think the one thing that's easier for people to agree on, especially people that are into wine or whatever level, is what is bad wine. And for me, what is bad wine is when it doesn't taste what the grape says. And, you know, too much chemical, too much sugar. But more than anything else, just that term, varietal topicity. Whenever I'm opening, I've had the $10 Chilean Viognier, the connoisseur, and used it for charity events and for this and that. And for me, what I like about it is I'm like, yeah, I can smell and taste the Viognier. It's not classic in terms of it's not filled with all this depth and stuff. But at the very least, this tastes and smells like Viognier. So at the very least, I'll give it a pass.
But do you really think it's varietal topicity that you're chasing after? Or is it more terroir topicity that you're tasting after? Like I'd put that to, I
see what you're saying,
because they're very different things, right?
Yes.
Like you're talking about Viognier as a grape, fine, but you would be a lot more disappointed. We'll use the Viognier example.
Yeah,
so say we're talking about Viognier and you've got this beautiful Condrieu from Northern Rhone, really classy wine, really great stuff, and you taste it and you're like, wow, gosh, tastes like Viognier, but it just, you know, it really lacks that opulence and the weight and that just sort of beauty, that pedigree that Condrieu has.
Mm-hmm.
Like for me, I think that it's that sort of, it's not necessarily the varietal topicity, but it's the terroir topicity. And I mean, think of wines where it's all about the blend, right? Think about like Chateauneuf du Pape. Yeah, there's a lot of Grenache in there. But I mean, it's a blended wine for most of the time,
yeah.
Right? So are you really looking for it to be Grenache-y, or are you looking for that Herbe de Provence and that beautiful orange peel and that potpourri and that sort of that? So I don't know. For me, I don't know if it would be as much about the variety, but more about that sort of expectation of place.
Yeah.
I
think they kind of go together. And you're right that the geography means as much as the grape. If I'm having Pinot from Russian River Valley, I have certain expectations, which is going to be different than mm-hmm. if I'm having it from, you know, Volnay, for instance.
Yes.
You know, it's going to be very different. I always like to flip around from topic to topic. And then I want you, the last thing, to do a grid tasting of a bottle of wine. And as it's your first time doing this, I do the same thing with Bruce Walder. I'm not going to blind you. If you agree to do another interview somewhere down the road...
Well, you can blind him. He's a master. I mean, what's he got to hide?
That's true. Bruce. And then I'll bring him some sort of like weird Portuguese
exactly.
wine. So I want to end there. But what do you think, just being a little more hyper-local, the Toronto wine scene?
Yeah.
Good, bad... right now, are you satisfied with the Toronto wine scene?
I think that it has a lot of great aspects to it. I think that there are a lot of talented individuals on the scene that are becoming more and more educated and are learning more about different wines in the world. I think that people are becoming more creative in their lists. I think there's a lot of positive things. I mm-hmm. think that I love going to wine bars. I would hope that in the future that good wine and being a cool wine bar and having great wine doesn't have to rely on weird natural wines.
Yeah.
that you are forced to drink. And if you don't drink them, you don't understand wine.
Yeah.
or if you send a wine back because it tastes like a boot,
yeah,
or, you know, some sort of, you know, an empty nail polish remover jar filled with Band-Aids left in the sun, that the sommelier doesn't come over and say, oh, well, I'm sorry.
This is exactly what
this is exactly how it's supposed to taste.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the natural wine movement's been great in Toronto. I think that we need to maybe, I don't know, right the ship a bit, shall
Sometimes
we say?
Sometimes the pendulum swings where everyone's celebrating. You can't see through the bottle of this wine. There's no filter at all.
I know.
Okay, that's wonderful, but how does it taste?
Yeah, so I think that I'd like to see maybe a little pullback on that one.
Yeah.
I think that the wine scene is growing, and I think that there's, again, that there's a lot of talented individuals out there. I think that the lists are becoming creative, and I think that the diners in Toronto are becoming more adventurous, which mm-hmm. encourages establishments and sommeliers to continue to grow and to experiment, which I think is very exciting.
Yeah, and which I love, because my biggest pet peeve is any restaurant that says wine bar somewhere in the title, and they've got four whites, four reds, maybe a rosé, and you already know ahead of time it's going to be a cheap Chardonnay. There's a Pinot Grigio. Their wild one is the Sauvignon yeah. Blanc from New Zealand.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that certain people like certain styles of wine.
Yeah.
You get a group of 10 people together and there's going to be common threads. So it's okay if you go into a wine bar and maybe you don't recognize the wines. But if this but if someone walks in and they say, "You know what? I typically really love drinking New World Chardonnay." There
yeah.
should be something that is similar in style in some sort of way that they can enjoy. Same way if someone walks in and says, "Oh, well, you know, I really like Pinot Grigio or Malbec,
yeah.
New World Malbec," or sort of these mainstays that you see in wine. They're big, they're important, and they're important for a reason. People like them. I think that it's great if you can have a cool list and all sorts of different esoteric things. It's awesome. But you should still be able to connect to your guests
yeah.
and be able to sort of meet their expectations and not leave them out stranded, like, well, gosh, I don't know what Encruzado is, and nothing, you know, nobody knows what's on this list, and I'm just lost.
Yeah.
So I think that there has to be a practical aspect of creating these lists as well.
Before we move on to blinding, I'm just curious, because your cue cards are here.
Yes.
What are you studying right now?
I'm studying really poorly right now. It's very embarrassing.
By the way, your idea of embarrassing and others are very different.
I'm back studying for the exam.
Mm-hmm.
It sits in July.
Yep, the master sommelier. Where is it in July?
I don't know. Maybe Texas? It
yep.
was last year. I'm not really sure where it will be this year. So I've started back studying. I was doing a little bit of... I was kind of focused on some stuff that I felt a little weak on. Now I'm going into Italy.
Yeah. Okay.
So why not?
Yeah, Italy. That's easy.
It's easy.
Are you focusing? Are you going to go... Do you go north to south? Do you do white to red?
I typically go. Actually, I go south to north.
South to north, okay.
And then I kind of do little deep dives as I go up.
Well, what's the most important river in? I was going to say in Sicily, but then I'm like, wait a minute, are there even any rivers in Sicily? I'm like, no, there's
not as much. You
no,
have the
no.
mountain, you have the Strait of Messina, you
yeah.
know, you have all that sort of stuff.
All right, so what are we drinking here?
You tell me.
Well, I gotta get my glasses.
It's definitely a wine.
Yeah.
It's a red wine.
Yeah.
Made from red grapes, I'm going to go out on a limb and say.
We are drinking from Margaux 2000, the Le Gascour. The La Soline de Gascour. I was at the National Club today, and I was sort of debating, you know, what to get you to do a blind.
Ooh, this is corked.
Oh, is it really?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, that was mean.
I know.
Oh, that was so
I
mean
know.
Of you. Like, literally, my heart dropped.
I know.
I was
but it was
out.
Worth it.
Oh.
It was worth it.
I was going through
for
with,
me.
It was.
For me,
for
it
you.
Was worth it.
I hate you so much. That was well done and good timing. I was going through with the wine director, Brian Perry, there. We're going through wines to get. And originally, I was going to bring a 2010 Copain, one of their Pinots.
Wow,
Which,
very different.
Which would have been, yeah. And then I saw this, and I'm like, no, we'll go with this because then I'll just take the rest home. And
absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm going to
go pick something nice up on the way home.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to pick up something nice to go with that. Just debating, is it Captain Crunch or Kraft Dinner? So what I'm going to do, same thing I did with Bruce. I'm just going to shut the hell up. And if you want, however you want to do it. And again, you know, you can
go. You want me to grid, don't you?
I want you to grid it. Oh, okay. But as intricate as you want, this is just up to you. Because again, for people that are always interested in this sort of stuff about what exactly happens at the tasting at the highest level.
Right, well, before you blank out, right?
Yeah, this Emily does represent at the highest level.
I blacked out. I'm not really sure what happened, but I passed. So I think I got some right. I don't know. It was sort of one of those moments. No, yeah, for sure. Okay, so we're going to taste this wine here. Yeah, shall we?
Go.
All right, let's do this. So wine number one, the only wine we have, is a red wine. It is clear. It is medium plus ruby, fading to a thin garnet rim. No CO2 sediment, and the viscosity is medium plus. On the nose, the wine is clean and vinous with medium plus intensity. Primary fruits are of red and black fruit. All right, we're in cranberry, we are in rhubarb, we are in raspberry, we're in black raspberry, sort of black plum, black cherries. The character of the fruit is just ripe, a little bit of underripeness in here as well. Actually, there's a little tiny bit of fig in here. It's really quite nice. But this wine isn't about the fruit on the nose, is it? No, it's all about the secondary stuff. So we have a little bit of bell pepper, green bell pepper, and we have beautiful forest floor. Just like you're walking outside in the fall right now. So you smell those beautiful leaves on the ground, like you're walking through a forest, kind of by a raspberry bush, one might even think. So forest floor, porcini mushroom, okay? Graphite, like pencil shavings, black tea, leather, cedar, like a cigar box. Not that I smoke cigars, but if I did, this is what it would smell like.
Yes.
Really, really quite complex. Some lovely herbal notes of rosemary, thyme, and sage, but kind of dried, like they've been hung. Really beautiful. All right, let's a little bit of cassis in here. And again, it's all about this sort of earthy tone here. It's really quite nice. Tiny bit of smoke and toast. Kind of indicates maybe this wine has seen a little bit of oak aging at some point. All right. Taste this wine. Okay. On the palate, this wine is dry. With medium plus bright acidity, medium plus fine tannins, medium alcohol, medium body, medium plus length. I'm going to even say this is a long finish. And it is medium plus complexity, and it's quite harmonious. Great. Primary fruits, again, are red and black fruits. So cranberry, raspberry, black raspberry, rhubarb, we're in these sort of more underripe fruits, black plum skin, black currant, blackberry. The character of the fruit is a little more underripe on the palate here, okay? So we've pulled a little bit of that ripeness back, a little bit tart here. But again, not about the fruit at all here. We have these secondary earthy, sort of earthy tones really pushing through on the palate here. So this beautiful forest floor, this crushed rock, pencil shavings and graphite, this beautiful sort of almost like a little bit of raspberry leaf and beautiful herbs of rosemary and thyme and sage, a little bit of smoke, black tea, kind of like an orange pekoe tea you're smelling, you're tasting here. And again, this sort of old leather, like an old bound leather book and a cedar box, really cigar box, a bit of cassis. Again, the fruit is more tart on the palate than it is on the nose. And the acid is really quite bright. It frames this wine quite nicely. Okay, so primary conclusions here. This wine is from the old world. I'm not going to say because it has a lot of terroir or it's mineral driven, but because, the fruit is a little more tart on the palate than it is on the nose. And we really are talking a lot about these mushrooms on the palate here and earth on the palate. This is from a moderate climate. So you do have a little bit of ripeness of fruit on the nose, but you have this beautiful punctuated acidity, all right, on the palate. So you know, these berries didn't get too hot. They weren't sweating it out in August, okay? So great. So we're in the old world. Well, we've got a blend here. So grapes, I think we've got a blend here. Cabernet Sauvignon. Okay. The color of the wine is red, moving into an aged sort of garnet here. We've got that sort of red and black fruits. It's full-bodied. I think there is a little bit of plushness in the mid-palate, maybe a little bit of Merlot, classic sort of Bordeaux blend of these beautiful grapes. Okay. Now, this is an aged wine. The way we know that, we have that beautiful garnet rim, and we're also talking about those leaves being dried and that sort of desiccated fruit. So I think the wine is older. Okay, so we're 10-plus years old here. All right. Possible countries of origin. France, obviously, we're talking about a Cabernet blend, but I'm going to also throw in, you know, the United States of America. I know people might be, oh, blasphemy, but there's a lot of great examples of really old Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley that, you know, I think give some of the best Bordeaux a run for their money. Great. But at the end of the day, I would have to go, also because I can see the label,
yeah,
that it is a Cabernet blend from the old world, from France, from Bordeaux, from the Left Bank. There you go. In 2000.
Yeah, Chateau, this is La Serine de Gascogne, which is the, I believe, the second wine for Chateau Gascogne again.
And it's delicious.
In Margaux. Yeah, it's really good. I've had this bottle before, at the National Club, where I'm a member. They got lots of that. So
it's really great. Yeah. So many, it's very complex, lots of layers.
Nice.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
Emily, thank you very much for doing this. I'd love to get you on again because things I didn't cover, and I knew I wasn't going to cover everything. Okay. I want to cover just competitions.
Oh, wow.
What's it like before, during, and afterwards? Like,
are we going to play Rocky in the background?
Yeah, oh, of course. Okay, we're going to do that. Also, at some point, I am going to get you to rank your favorite wines, but I will give you specific questions ahead of time.
All right.
To get you thinking about it. And also, I want to talk next time about how you properly shamed me into realizing that a very semi-cult-like Pinot.
Yes, it took years.
From Sonoma, yeah, is actually more like a Pinot Syrah blend.
Yeah, and it took really years for that. Yeah. And I eventually ruined it for you.
You did ruin it for
You're
me.
You're welcome.
But by ruining it for me, you actually made it all better.
Thank you. I'm happy.
Emily Pierce, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.